Josh could see the small flame burning in the heart of the orb, as Seth picked it up and balanced the glass on his palm. He rolled it out to the edge of his fingertips, then brought his hand around quickly, so the orb seemed almost to stick to the back of his hand as it rolled, threatening to fall and shatter into a thousand pieces before he brought it back under control again. All the while, Seth stared at Josh, never breaking eye contact.
"Oh, my God! He's still alive under there!"
"Help me get to him! Jesus! Jesus fucking Christ! What a mess! For the love of all things holy!
Look at his head!
Fucking hell! How is he still breathing? Oh, gods! Oh, gods! Look at him!"
There was a commotion behind Josh. He didn't turn. He didn't want to see what was happening. Hearing it was enough. The reflections in the cafe window were more than enough. Together they were too much. The ambulance sirens neared, but there was no way they were going to be able to negotiate the narrow street and its jammed traffic fast enough.
"Hang in there. Don't worry. It's going to be okay. The ambulance is on the way. Look at me. Look at my face. Don't close your eyes."
"Roll him over. We should roll him over."
"No."
"What if he chokes on his blood or drowns on it or something? We should put him in the recovery position. Poor bastard."
"Leave him where he is. He's not going to choke. He's face down."
Movement. The dragging of a dead weight across the tarmac as they pulled the comedians out from beneath the bus. And still Josh didn't turn.
"I said, holy fuck.
What's wrong with his face?"
Josh watched as Seth leaned forward, and with a careless tilt of the wrist, let the glass orb roll back to his fingertips, teeter on the edge, and then fall. The glass hit the linoleum floor by his feet. The impact shattered it, and snuffed out the last flickering life from the flame at its heart. Behind Josh, one of the Good Samaritans said,
"It's too late. He's gone."
And Josh knew that somehow Seth had relinquished his hold on the thing, letting it go into whatever passed for its endless night. That was the only reason it was dead, not the bus, not the crushing damage it had caused to the comedians. They had served their purpose. By shattering the glass, he'd extinguished more than just the light. He'd snuffed out whatever magic that had kept that thing alive. Never taking his eyes off Josh, Seth pushed himself up out of his seat. The fact that he was here, waiting for Josh to emerge from the shadow, meant that he knew, didn't it? Meant that he knew it all. He knew that Boone had left his grandson more than just a lighter in his well. He knew all about Isaiah's legacy. He knew that Josh had found Eleanor Raines in her lost London prison, which in turn meant he knew all about the weakness in Glasstown's invisible walls. And he knew all of that because Josh had just stepped out of the place in front of his eyes. Seth Lockwood was every bit the devil Isaiah had painted him to be. 27. Lost Week. Julie Gennaro left the car door open as he walked over to the dead men. He hadn't seen them coming. They had quite literally stepped out of nowhere, right in front of him. He was shaking, not just because he'd hit two pedestrians, but because of what he'd seen as they'd gone up over his bonnet. That face, those teeth, the impossibly wide, predatory smile as the mouth opened wider and wider, then spiraling shut like the metal jaws of a garbage truck as the guy's head came down, cannoning off the bonnet, before impact dragged the body away. It was like something dreamed up by a fever, a nightmare given flesh and set down in the middle of an East London street, and all Julie could do was stare at the bus driver's face as he tried so desperately to stop, the true horror of it being that he knew he couldn't. It all happened so incredibly slowly, like some sort of jerky stop-motion film playing out, only it was real, life and death real.
"Look at the mess, poor bastard. Christ! He's lucky he didn't make it."
Another speaker, a voice almost reverential.
"I mean, who would want to live looking like that?"
One of the first responders finally said what they were all thinking. His voice, and callous disregard for human life, carried across the street. But no one was arguing with him. Death, in this case, was a small mercy.
What about the other one? Can someone get him out from under there?
Then,
Christ! He looks like... God! Who? That old comedian? Holy shit! They killed Craik and Clamp!
A kid said, and laughed. Laughed. Julie didn't need to see another corpse. He was more interested in the man who had been running away from the deceased. He had a story to tell. He stood in the middle of the road, one foot on either side of the white line, staring across the street at something. Julie went across to him.
You okay, sir?
He didn't say anything. Julie put a hand on his shoulder and asked again.
Are you all right?
The man shook his head as though to say no. No, he wasn't all right. How could he be all right? He just stepped out of thin air, chased by a monster that lay dead beneath a double-decker bus. Why the ridiculous question?
Sir, are you all right, sir? Sir, are you okay? Can you hear me? Are you hurt?
I need to get out of here.
I don't think so, sir. What's your name?
Josh.
Okay, Josh. You're a very lucky man. Do you know that?
He shook his head again, denying any relationship with that particularly capricious lady. Julie didn't think arguing the point would help, so instead he asked,
Do you want to tell me what just happened?
I don't.
Julie couldn't tell if he was saying he didn't want to, or if he'd simply run out of words in the middle of saying he didn't understand himself, which, given the face Julie had seen, all of those teeth, the eyes pushed back and away into the temples, swiveling like some apex predators, was pretty fucking understandable, to be blunt.
Stay with me, Josh. What's happened? Why were they chasing you? Where were you all coming from? 1 minute the road was empty, the next I was trying not to kill you. Talk to me, Josh. I'm your friend here.
I don't have any friends,
Josh said, still staring toward the cafe across the street. Julie saw a good-looking guy in the doorway who was staring right back at them.
You know that guy?
As he asked, the man in the doorway drew his finger across his neck in one smooth motion, as though slitting his throat. Julie recognized him then. He'd seen him a lot over the last month or so with Gideon Lockwood in the Rothery. Wherever Gideon was, there he was, on his shoulder, in the thick of it. That made the threat all the more visceral. The Lockwoods didn't piss about with words when actions would get the message across much more emphatically. Josh nodded.
Seth, he said.
Let's get you out of here, shall we? Then you can tell me what you've done to upset old man Lockwood. Come on.
Julie wrapped an arm around Josh's shoulder and steered him toward the side of the road. The ambulance turned onto the street as they reached the pavement. The paramedics were out of it and moving spectators away before the engine had stopped ticking over.
Nothing to see here, folks,
one of them called, shooing people back, making some breathing space for the crew to get in and work.
How about you let us do our jobs? Come on, thanks, yeah, back, back.
Seeing Julie's uniform, another one of the paramedics came over to him.
Everything okay here?
Julie nodded.
I've got this guy. He's fine. Shock. He's a lucky lad. Could have been a lot worse for him.
Hard to argue. I've seen the others,
the paramedic said, nodding toward the bus.
Want me to give him a once-over anyway?
Nah, it's fine. You've got enough to deal with. I'm going to take him back to the station, ask him a few questions, see if I can work out what the fuck just happened here. Just waiting for backup to arrive.
The paramedic nodded, and was already halfway back to the worst of the accident before Julie whispered into Josh's ear.
I don't know what the fuck's going on, but I saw that thing. And either I'm losing my fucking mind, or some shit's happening here I don't understand. So we're going to talk,
You're going to tell me everything you know. Understand? And before you think about lying to me, I know that guy. I know what kind of bastard he is, and that you're in trouble. Okay?
He didn't wait for Josh to answer him. Thinking about it, he knew the victims, too. Or at least of them. He'd heard a kid say they'd killed Crake and Clamp and laugh. That was the second time he'd heard those names recently, Crake and Clamp. They'd been behind the Magic Circle robbery, and now they were dead. There was no such thing as a coincidence in his line of work, meaningful or otherwise. The world just didn't work that way.
Now, we're going to go over there and get into my car. We're going to close the door and drive away. And you're going to start explaining. Don't leave anything out. Don't try and hide anything. I'll know if you're lying. This is what I do, and I'm good at it. Do we understand each other, Josh?
Josh didn't say anything as Julie led him to the car, but he didn't resist either, and compliance was as good as acceptance as far as the policeman was concerned. Julie put his hand on his head and eased him down into the back seat, slamming the door on him before going around to the driver's side. The child locks kept his passenger in place. He hadn't taken the keys out of the ignition when he'd abandoned the car. Before Julie could get behind the wheel, he heard someone ask,
"What the fuck?"
Only to be answered by an equally perturbed,
"He's melting? Fading? Where the hell did he go? Jesus, I'm losing my fucking mind. There was a corpse here 2 seconds ago."
He didn't wait to find out what they were talking about. He clambered into the driver's seat, and with the sounds of fresh sirens rolling into the busy street, gunned the engine, putting the car into reverse. He was 200 yards from the scene before he said a word. When he did, it was only the one.
"Spill!"
His passenger looked back at him through the rearview mirror. There was something about him that Julie recognized, some nagging familiarity. He'd seen him before somewhere, but where? Julie looked him in the eye, waiting for him to say something, but he didn't. And then it hit him. He hadn't actually seen the man before, not in the flesh, but he'd been looking, or rather not looking, at his face on and off for the last week on lampposts all across the Rothery.
"You're him, aren't you? The guy who went missing from the funeral last week?"
"I don't think so," Josh said.
"Oh, no. It is you."
He was sure of himself now.
"I was out at your place twice. Once with my partner, responding to a burglary call in the middle of the night. The place had been tossed. A woman met us at the door. I thought she was the owner. She wasn't. I realized that the second time I was there, when I sat with your mother and your sister, and they told me how you'd called to say you wouldn't be home that night, but then hadn't come home at all, and they were frightened you'd gone after the burglars yourself. Oh, believe me, I know you. I've been turning the estate over brick by brick, looking for you, and dreading telling your mother if I'd actually found you under one of them."
He shook his head.
"Where the fuck have you been for the last week?"
Josh had no answer for that.
"Okay. Well, I guess I'm taking you home and you can explain it to your family," Julie said,
indicating right at the end of the street, and merging with the main flow of traffic that would eventually lead them back to the Rothery.
"What the hell kind of trouble are you in, mate?"
28. Prodigal Son. Josh didn't say a word all the way back to the house. He didn't know what he could say. A week? It couldn't be a week since the funeral. It was impossible. But as they turned into the estate, he saw the first of the posters his mother had glued up on one of the telephone poles. It was his face. The word "missing" was right there in block capitals above it, and their phone number beneath it. He didn't know what he was supposed to think. He'd been at the funeral 2 days ago. He'd spent the night at the flat in Rotherhithe, and then the rest of the day chasing clues left by Boone. He'd stood face to face with Damiola last night. He'd seen incredible things, yes, but they'd only happened to him yesterday. He'd seen an iron raven do battle with dead comedians with mouths like sharks. He'd met a woman who hadn't aged a day in 90 years, and set foot in a part of London that hadn't existed for just as long. He was surrounded by impossible things. What was one more? He was about to ask the obvious question, but took his phone from his pocket to check the date and time on it instead, forgetting that the battery was dead. It didn't matter. He was already beginning to believe crossing the length of Glasstown had taken days, not minutes.
"I can't leave this place. Not for more than a few minutes. You'll see why when you leave."
Now he was seeing why. Minutes there were days here. The policeman looked at him through the mirror again. Josh turned away from his scrutiny, looking out through the window instead of making eye contact. It was the first time he'd stopped running since the break-in, and with the adrenaline draining from his system, he was left feeling utterly and completely exhausted, and lost. There was no fight left in him, just acceptance. If this was the way the world was, then this is the way the world had to be. It really was as simple as that. If a man could weave magic and make people and places fold away in space and time somehow, then men could weave magic and make people and places fold away in space and time. QED. Denying that, pretending it wasn't happening, that the wonderful wasn't possible, forcing himself to believe that the amazing wasn't actually part of the human condition, all of that was counterproductive. It was. It had to be, because he'd experienced it. He'd run through streets in minutes, only to emerge from them a week later. He'd been chased by monsters, and talked to a woman who was 109 years old, and looked bloody good for it. Who was to say what was and wasn't possible anymore? Not him, that was for sure. The streets became more and more familiar, until they finally pulled up outside of Boone's house. Only, of course, it wasn't Boone's house anymore. It was their house, and only their house. That would take some getting used to. The policeman clambered out of the car and came around to open his door. Josh didn't want to get out. But then he saw the front door open, and he saw his mother, Rosie Raines, standing there, the look of desperate fear on her face. He knew what she was thinking in that moment. A police car at the door. The driver had to be the bearer of bad news. Then, even as grief tore at her, there was no mistaking the sudden, overwhelming flood of relief as she saw Josh emerge from the back seat. Rosie stood there for the longest time, staring at her son, then came running up the drive toward the car, arms out blindly. She swept him up in a fierce embrace before he could straighten up, only to push him away and start beating at his chest with the full force of her fists, weeping and gulping down air, and trying not to choke and say something all at once. It took Josh a second to realize what she was saying.
"I thought you were dead! I thought you were dead!"
The same words over and over, until they lost all sense and meaning.
"I thought you were dead!"
Josh pulled her close, crushing his mother's fists between their chests, and held her tight until she stopped fighting him. Rosie shuddered against him, struggling to breathe, but he refused to let her go.
"It's okay. I'm here," he said. "I'm home."
She leaned back, arching her spine to pull away from him so that she could look at his face, like she couldn't believe it was really him, that it had to be some horrible prank being played on her by the universe. And then she hit him again. Just once. Hard. Before she broke down into uncontrollable sobs, snot and spittle dribbling out of her nose and mouth, as she tried to say thank you to the policeman who had brought the prodigal son home. Then behind her, Josh heard his baby sister yell,
"You bastard! You thoughtless fucking bastard!"
Alexandra Raines came running out of the house.
"Not the sort of homecoming you were expecting, eh?"
the policeman said wryly.
"That's what happens when you disappear for 7 days without so much as a peep."
"Where the hell have you been, Josh?"
He shook his head. It was no easier to explain now than it had been 10 minutes ago, and it would be no easier in 10 minutes, 10 days, or even 10 years' time, for that matter. There were no words that wouldn't sound like lies. "I don't know," he said. Lexi was chalk to his cheese, salt to his pepper, yin to yang, tortoise to hare, and every other diametric and polar opposite. They couldn't have looked more physically different if geneticists had taken random eggs and sperm from donors and fused them in a petri dish. Growing up, he tormented her mercilessly, claiming that she was variously the window cleaner's daughter, the postman's, the milkman's, while they still had a milkman. And in return, she came home from art class one day to present him with a homemade birth certificate that named him heir of some Nigerian prince's millions. Family stuff. Normal. She was a nurse down at St. Thomas's by the river. She'd been on the long-term care ward for 5 months. She spent most of her nights looking after an old woman who never woke up. He knew everything about her. She knew everything about him. But the way she looked at him now, it was like she'd never seen him before in her life. That scared him more than anything that had happened since the funeral. This was his baby sister. She knew him better than he knew himself.
"We should take this inside," the policeman said, gently easing them in the direction of the door. "Especially if you intend on killing him now he's home safe and sound."
He nodded toward twitching curtains across the street.
"Fewer witnesses."
Rosie nodded, allowing herself to be led inside. She didn't seem to realize it was a joke. They'd cleaned up the mess since he was last here. The memory of the woman upstairs going through Boone's things was visceral. It gripped him, clenched his gut and twisted. He winced, looking instinctively toward the stairs, like he still expected to see her waiting at the top. The landing was empty. There was no Myrna Shepherd looking down at him. Still, he shivered at the thought of it.
"I'll make a cup of tea,"
Rosie said, as though she'd hit up on the last great secret of the universe in a perfect eureka moment.
"You like tea, Officer Gennaro?"
"That'd be great," the policeman said. There was a look that passed between the policeman and his sister. It was there and then it was gone, but it had definitely been there. They weren't strangers.
"We'll go sit down in the front room while you put a brew on."
She came back through a few minutes later, balancing a tray loaded with the finest china and a pot of tea stewing. She took a seat opposite them. No one really seemed to know what to say, now they were all face to face with no pretend errands to run. There was one question they obviously wanted to ask. Lexi broke the silence.
"Where have you been?"
She leaned forward, a fringe falling over her face. Josh looked at her, and for just a moment wished they shared some sort of telepathic bond, so she could see it, so that he could make her understand. But he knew she'd never believe him, so he said,
"I don't know,"
and offered a shrug.
"What do you mean you don't know?"
Lexi pressed. His sister had never been one for letting go of a bone once she'd got her teeth into it.
"Are you seriously going to pretend you've got amnesia? That you just woke up now, and everything that happened since Granddad's funeral is just a bloody blur?"
"No, not that," Josh said, helplessly.
"Then what? Why the hell didn't you just ring? Do you know what we've been going through here? We thought you were dead, Josh. We thought you were dead. So the least you can do is tell us where the fuck you were."
But he couldn't. No matter what he owed them, no matter what they'd been through, he couldn't tell them where he'd been, because it was one thing to think something, to come around to accepting it, no matter how impossible, even embrace it, but it quite another to share it with someone you loved when you knew they'd think you were mad for believing it. He reached across and took his mum's hand, ignoring Lexi for a moment. The room reduced to two people.
"I'm sorry, Mum,"
Josh said, and meant it. He'd never meant anything more in his life. She looked up at him with so much sadness in her eyes, he thought his heart might just break beneath the burden of it. He squeezed her hand. He knew it wasn't just about him. It was about Boone and about his father and her own father. All of the men in her life, the ones she gave her heart to, always left her. He was her last man, and she thought she'd lost him, just like she'd lost his dad when he'd gone out to buy that packet of cigarettes. Life had a cruel sense of humor sometimes. He didn't know what to say to make that better.
They fired you, you know? Mike Nicholson called from the office. He was very polite about it, but said they couldn't keep your job open indefinitely. The second time he called, he was less polite. Concerned, I think, that you might never come home. But he said they had to fill your post. Still, you're home now. That's all that counts.
Why don't you talk us through it, Josh? Julie Gennaro said, intruding gently on the moment.
Everything you can remember from the funeral onward. This is a safe place. No one is going to judge you. You never know. It might help saying stuff aloud.
I doubt it, Josh said, letting go of his mum's hand to reach for one of the cups. He didn't drink from it. He cradled it in both hands. He couldn't look his mum in the eye as he explained what had happened after Boone's funeral, how he'd slipped out the back and met his cousin in the yard behind the Scala, how Lockwood had asked if Boone had left him anything in his will, and how he'd returned home to find some woman in the process of robbing the place. He didn't say she looked like a long-dead Hollywood icon, or that she glowed blue. There were some things that didn't need sharing.
"And you think Gideon Lockwood was behind the break-in?"
the policeman asked, pushing him toward the truth.
"You think that he sent the woman to find whatever he suspected your grandfather left you?"
"Seth," Josh corrected him without thinking. "And yes, that's exactly what I think."
"So, do you mind if I ask what your grandfather left you?"
"Nothing," Josh said, a little too quickly. Julie Gennaro's lip twitched. Maybe it was his bullshit detector pinging. Josh figured cops had fairly finely tuned BS detectors. People lie to them all the time. Maybe not big fat lies, just little ones to make them look better, or make sure they took themselves out of the frame.
"That's a lot of trouble to go for nothing, if you don't mind me saying, Josh."
"We haven't had the will reading yet,"
Rosie said, supporting her son.
"We were supposed to do it on Monday, but with Josh gone..."
She didn't finish the thought.
"Ah, so Lockwood might not actually be wrong then. There could be something. Any idea what it might be that Lockwood thinks it might be?"
"I wouldn't know," Josh said, finding it a little easier to lie now that his mother had given him a way to wriggle around the truth.
"Okay."
Gennaro seemed to accept his denial at face value.
"So what happened next?"
"You went after him, didn't you?"
Lexi blurted the words out.
"Oh, you fucking idiot. You promised me you weren't going to do anything stupid. But you went after Lockwood, didn't you?"
Lexi pushed herself up out of her chair. She didn't know what to do with herself. She couldn't storm out, but she couldn't sit still either. So she stood there, fists clenching and unclenching impotently.
"What did you do?"
What she really meant was, what kind of trouble are you really in? He could see the cogs clicking into place, and two making about 6,027, as she leaped to all sorts of worst-case conclusions. He could guess what they were. He'd gone after Lockwood, lost badly, and they'd taken him prisoner. That was the only way she could rationalize him not calling, not letting them know he was alive, because he couldn't. That changed the way she looked at him. She stared at Josh, looking for signs of it on his body. There had to be bruises, cuts, something. Some marks to prove he wasn't just a fucking selfish bastard for making them suffer. Josh held out his hands for her to see.
"I'm all right," he promised, knowing she didn't believe him. "Really?"
"Did they hurt you?"
That was his mother's next question.
"No, I'm fine," Do you know where they held you?
That was the policeman. He started to say, didn't, but knowing that by denying that he'd been held captive, he'd have to find another excuse for his disappearance, stopped himself.
Isn't it enough that I'm back? I'm not hurt. I'm safe.
Obviously, that's between you guys, Julie said. If you tell me there's no crime here, there's really not a lot I can do apart from enjoy this touching family moment. But I'd advise you strongly to tell the truth.
Josh shrugged.
Okay. Well, do me a favor. Walk me back to the car, will you? If that's okay with you, Mrs. Raines.
Rosie nodded. They left the house together. Outside, Julie said,
Okay, mate. You're not a bad liar. I'll give you that. But you're far from a good one. What is Lockwood after, and don't think about lying to me again. There's just me and you here. You don't have to worry about protecting your mother from the truth. I don't care what you're involved in, but I want to know what happened to you. What's going on here? You know a lot more than you're letting on.
I really don't know if I can explain it.
Try. You won't believe me. Again, try me. I've seen some shit over the last couple of hours. You never know. I might wind up being the friend you need.
Josh shrugged.
Okay, but it's better that I show you. Then maybe you want to let your mum know we're taking a little trip. Wouldn't want her thinking you disappeared again, would we?
29. A problem shared, or two lives ruined. Josh took Julie to the flat in Rotherhithe. You wanted to know what Boone left me. This is it in all of its glory.
This place?
The policeman asked, looking up at the dark windows.
Nice. Must be good to have rich relatives.
You say that now, but you might not think so in a minute. Josh opened the door. Welcome to the obsessive world of the Raines family, Constable Gennaro. Josh led him upstairs. You might want to brace yourself. You're about to enter a whole lot of crazy. Julie nodded, it all beginning to come clear.
So this is where you got to for a week? Some sort of love nest you didn't want to tell your mother about? No telephone, I take it?
Well, not quite. I think it's best if I just open the door and let you see for yourself. And so saying, Josh opened the lounge door and stepped aside to let the policeman enter the room. There was a momentary silence followed by a slow whistle, which in turn was followed by...
Holy shit! You weren't kidding. What is this place?
My inheritance, Josh said. This little lot is what Boone left me.
Julie turned and turned about, trying to take it all in, just as Josh had the first time he'd walked into the room. The sheer amount of articles and photographs Boone and Isaiah had gathered about Eleanor's disappearance and events surrounding it was overwhelming. But that was nothing compared to the web of threads linking them all. Crazy was the only rational word for it. The policeman walked across to the nearest wall, ducking under the colored yarns, to read some of the vast wealth of information plastered up there.
You think this is what Lockwood wants? Some old newspaper articles?
It's not what they are, Josh said. It's what they're about. Read them.
Josh waited for Julie to skim a few and get the gist of the crime the room was dedicated to, before taking him next door. He was putting his trust in the policeman, with no real reason to think he was worthy of it, or that he'd keep it safe for the fact he'd obviously seen the comedians, even if he didn't understand what it was he'd seen.
An actress disappeared nearly 100 years ago. Seriously? This is the big mystery that kept you away for a week?
He shook his head like he couldn't quite believe the answer was something so understandable, after all of the intimations he'd have to see it to believe it.
There's stuff in here he'd rather no one knew, Josh said, looking toward the wall obsessed with Damiola's antics. Look, even if his grandfather was complicit in the kidnapping, it's water under the bridge now. We're talking about a century. Crimes don't last that long, no matter how shocking they are at the time. Unless we're talking something like Jack the Ripper, no one's interested. And even then it's purely academic. You need to face it, Josh. They got away with it. And believe me, that family have gotten away with a lot worse over the last 20 years.
They haven't gotten away with it. Julie looked at him. Then he seemed to realize why Josh hadn't gone home, and that it had nothing to do with love nests or lost weekends with lovers hiding away from the world.
You disappeared down a rabbit hole chasing this lot, didn't you? Jesus, mate, that's insane. Let it go.
There's something I need to show you if you're going to understand, but you might not want to see it.
There you go again, all vague and mysterious. Look, you need to know this. I'm a cop in London. The Rothery's part of my beat. I see the worst humanity has to offer every single day, without fail. And let's not forget what happened today. I might not have killed two men, but I hit them trying to get out of your way. I'm pretty sure there's very little you could say that will shock me.
No matter what happened out there, you wouldn't have killed two men, Josh said, but didn't elaborate. And honestly, no matter what you think, you haven't seen it all. We can remedy that, though. Come with me. They went through to the projection room, where Josh fed the film back into the reel, while Julie worked his way around the walls, looking at Eleanor and Eleanor and Eleanor.
She was really something,
he said after a while.
That she is.
Josh powered up the projector and set the Lost Hitchcock playing once more. If the policeman noticed the switch in tense from past to present, he didn't say anything. This was going to be her breakthrough. If she hadn't disappeared, she'd have been our Louise Brooks or Garbo. And naming film stars, he was immediately reminded of the woman rifling through Boone's room, Myrna Shepherd. The film flickered, the first few seconds blurry before it settled down. Josh added his own narration. Hitchcock began shooting on his first film, Number 13, in the early 1920s. It's a lost film. No one's seen it in years. The common belief is that the film itself was melted down for its chemical content, that being more valuable than what was on it. What you're watching is a little piece of cinematic history.
Must be worth a pretty penny, Julie said,
as though he'd just found Lockwood's motivation in all of this. I can't even begin to imagine what it's worth, Josh agreed. A lot. It's Hitchcock. But not just that. It's the first ever Hitchcock, abandoned because he ran out of money.
So the way you're explaining this, maybe this whole mess isn't as mysterious as you think. Most things come down to money in the end, even with a nasty piece of work like Lockwood.
This isn't about money. It never was. It's all about the girl, Eleanor Raines.
Ah, the other classic motive. Sex and money. I'd be out of a job without those twin vices.
I don't want to tell you anything about the film itself, Josh said. I don't want to influence you in any way. I just want you to watch. No preconceptions, no prejudices.
I can do that.
For the best part of half an hour, the pair of them stood spellbound as the young director worked his magic, the actors and actresses telling their silent story of homelessness and murder. Julie recognized the pub across the street and realized the flat was in the middle of the set. He remarked as much. Josh nodded. It wasn't much, but he was glad the detective had caught the geographic significance of Boone's secret place. Maybe he'd see the rest without prodding. When they came to those 30 seconds near the end, when Seth Lockwood drifted across the background of the shot, then turned to stare at the camera, out of the screen and straight at them, Julie Gennaro pointed.
That's him, isn't it? The guy from the cafe?
He shook his head, doubting himself.
That's Lockwood.
That's Seth Lockwood, Josh agreed. I'm sure of it.
This is what you wanted me to see?
Josh nodded. This is part of what I wanted you to see. Seth Lockwood in flesh, side by side with Eleanor Raines days before she disappeared.
Well, there's no doubt it offers a compelling narrative in terms of means, motive, and opportunity. But I hate to break it to you. It's impossible. It can't be the same guy that was threatening you earlier. Not if the film was shot almost 100 years ago.
Josh could see him struggling to make it fit. It didn't. That was the problem. The pieces didn't fit into any rational, mundane picture.
It's been tampered with, hasn't it? Edited. He's been added to the shot somehow.
It's good. Clever. You almost had me.
But he can't be there and here at the same time, not looking the same. It's not possible.
And yet he's right there. Believe me.
Did you do it? Is this your handiwork?
And then, as the images flickered on unsteadily, Julie saw a second familiar face projected against the wall and did a wild double take, shaking his head.
You? Okay, what the fuck's going on here? This whole thing stinks. You're playing me for a fool. All this you-won't-believe-your-eyes shit. Okay, well played. You almost had me. But I'm out of here.
That's not me, Josh said. That's my great-grandfather, Isaiah. Julie thought about it for a moment.
Fine. Then applying the same logic, that's not Lockwood. If it can happen once, it can happen twice. That's his great-grandfather and your great-grandfather, and by some freak of genetics, you both look just like dead men. That I can believe. Just about. At least it's more believable than the alternative.
It would be easier if that was true. But... Josh shrugged.
But, fucking but.
That was a big word. But.
I need to tell you something. That sounds eerily like a confession's coming, Julie said.
No, but if you don't believe what you've seen so far, there's no way you're going to believe the rest of what I've got to say.
Frankly, you're right. I don't believe you. There's a scam here. I just don't know what it is. And I don't appreciate you taking the piss like this. I've got better things to do with my life than waste it being dicked by a bunch of petty criminals.
There's no scam. But I don't know how to convince you other than to show you.
Fine. Show me.
He spread his arms wide. He'd hoped the projection room would sell it. But he had other alternatives now, thanks to Damiola. 13 of them burned on the floor in the other room, the locations of the anchors. With Damiola's glass, he would be able to peel back the layers of illusion hiding them and show the policeman. That would change the way he looked at the world.
Okay, come with me.
He led Julie back through to the other room and knelt down, placing his hand on one of the scorch marks burned into the floorboard. It was where he'd found Damiola's workshop and bludgeoned his way through into Glasstown.
These marks aren't random. They're important. It's a map. I can see that. London. But it's not right.
It is. I'll show you. But you need to understand what's at risk. He can't know we're sniffing around. If he finds out, I don't want to think about what he'll do to Eleanor.
By him you mean Lockwood?
Josh nodded. She made me promise. If he knows there's a way in, he'll kill her. Or us. Or both. Seth is a monster. I don't doubt that for a second. I've already seen some of what he's capable of. That thing you hit.
The men?
They weren't men, Josh said. Not like you and me.
Look, Josh, you seem like a decent guy. But I'll be honest with you. I don't believe a word that's coming out of your mouth. Did Taff put you up to this?
30. The Tale of One Bent Bastard. Taff Carter was in paradise. Myrna Shepherd knelt between his legs, taking him into her mouth again. There was more pleasure than he'd ever imagined in dying. That was the lesson she was teaching him. She was the most exquisite creature he'd ever encountered, which made it a lesson he was happy to learn, welcoming the fact that he grew weaker by the ejaculation, diminished, so that she might be sustained. She looked up at him. Her eyes were alive. That was his gift to her.
"Perhaps it's better if I live in your heart, where the world can't see me. If I'm dead, there will be no stain on our love."
"This isn't love," he thought in some disconnected part of his mind, but didn't fight her. In a week he had gone from being an overweight slob of a man to the wretched wreck of skin and bone, stripped of fat, muscle degenerated to the point of emaciation, slouched on the couch in his dark lounge, and still she fed on him, even though there was nothing left to give. There was an unquenchable emptiness to the woman between his legs. That hollowness was in part what made her so compelling. That and her face. Her beautiful, beautiful face. This succubus was so much more than perfection. She was a distillation of beauty, a reduction of the divine. He couldn't imagine his life without her now, even if it meant sacrificing what little remained of it to feed her and keep her with him. "That," he thought, "is a death worth dying." A song played on the stereo. He used to know what it was called. It had been one of his favorites before she came into his life. Saxophone. That was the instrument. Such a sad sound. Like so much else in the last week, the name of it had slipped away from him. Myrna Shepherd's hand still cupped him. She worked him, even as it began to go flaccid. Each gesture was harsher than it was tender. "I can't," he said, meaning he was spent, exhausted, no matter that his body was trying to rise to the occasion, meaning he needed to rest, gather himself. But she was hungry. His traitorous body couldn't help but respond as she refused to let him shrivel. Holding eye contact, staring deep into him, she took him all the way into the back of her throat. Taff buried his fingers in the terry cloth of his dressing gown as she used her tongue to draw a hitching breath from his lips, and with a glint of mischief in her eyes, she milked him until he stiffened beyond anything comfortable or pleasurable.
"Please," he said.
"No,"
he said. "Please,"
he said.
"Shit,"
he gasped.
"Fuck,"
he screamed, and every muscle in his body tensed.
"My beautiful boy,"
she sighed.
"We only live this life once, and if we are honest, once is enough."
He couldn't argue with her. He couldn't think beyond the need for this to be over. Once, with her in his life, was more than enough for him, even if it wasn't for her. His orgasm when it came was furious. There was blood in the seed as it seeped out of him. Myrna Shepherd wiped her mouth and stood, sated. For now. She still wore the white dress she'd arrived at his door in. During all their time together, each time they'd fucked, he'd not once seen her naked. It was almost as though she and the white dress were one. The fabric fused inextricably onto her torso, while its folds billowed around her legs. She was happy enough to raise her skirts for him. Shepherd swirled her skirts as she walked away, kicking up her heel. After what had just passed between them, it was a curiously innocent gesture, playful. But then it was impossible to separate what was genuine and what was an act with the woman. Or maybe it was all theater. That didn't mean he didn't appreciate her playing the ingenue. It was just hard to reconcile the two images of her, Madonna and whore. Gideon Lockwood and his new boy had sent her to him, a gift, to buy his loyalty for a few more years to come. It had felt like a bargain at the time. But what had Lockwood said? "Remember, you asked for it." or something like that. Men like Taff Carter didn't get to fuck women like her. That was one of the fundamental laws of nature. No matter how much he wanted to deny it, pretend he was doing something noble, or that he had no choice in the matter, the truth was that he was a bent bastard, just like Lockwood had mocked. Taff didn't care anymore. He was too exhausted to move. He just sat on the settee, dressing gown open beneath him, and stared down the bones of his ribcage to his cock, where it stuck uselessly against his thigh. The blood scared him. He didn't even move to cover himself when the doorbell rang, or a few seconds later when the door opened. He just reached down to cup his balls and cover his modesty. Seth Lockwood strolled into the room, all unpleasant smiles.
"Well, if it isn't my little pet pig. Oink, oink. I would ask how you're enjoying my little gift, but I can see the answer to that a little too clearly for my liking. Do you think you could stop playing with yourself for a minute?"
Taff didn't move. Seth waited. Taff looked up at him, eyes all but useless after the damage they'd taken from the succubus's thumbs, his brain running slow.
"That means take your fucking hand away from your miserable little cock while I'm talking to you, you perverted little bell-sniff."
Taff did as he was told.
"And cover yourself up. I really don't want to see the shit stains on your dressing gown. Thank you very much."
He pulled the trailing edge of the terry cloth up over his groin, but didn't belt it.
"I'm very disappointed in you, Hugh," the gangster said. "I thought we had a deal. Didn't we have a deal? I give you your lovely fuck toy, and in return you give me what I want. Wasn't that the deal?"
Taff nodded.
"So where's my glass? I don't see it. Unless you've got it shoved up your rectal passage. Have you got it shoved up there?"
Taff shook his head.
"I didn't think so. So, like I said, I'm very disappointed in you. Do you know what I do to people who disappoint me?"
"Hurt them," the Welshman said.
"Very good, Hugh. I hurt them. So do you know what I'm going to do to you?"
"Hurt me."
"You're on fire. You're on fucking fire. Or you will be, at any rate."
And so saying, Seth took a silver hip flask from his back pocket, unscrewed the cap, and splashed the contents all over the man and the couch in front of him, as though he was dousing them in holy water. Only it wasn't holy water, and it wasn't whiskey either. The reek of petrol filled the cramped room. Seth took a cigarette packet and lighter from his pocket.
"But you know what? There's been enough dying today already. I'm feeling forgiving. I can understand why you've been distracted. She really is something. A gift from the gods, and a miserable shit like you doesn't come into the orbit of such a heavenly creature often. I get it."
He put a cigarette between his lips, lit it and inhaled, drawing the smoke into his lungs. He exhaled, letting the curls of smoke raft up in front of his face.
"I do, honestly. But there's a difference between my understanding it and my thinking it's okay."
Seth tapped the ash off the cigarette tip.
"From where I'm standing, you still owe me, Hugh, and it's spoiling my good mood." "What do you want?" "Ah, good question. I've always liked a man who gets straight to the point rather than dicking about. Honestly, I want to watch you burn, but I can wait to have my fun. In the meantime, I can use you. Your partner is getting in to be a real pain in the arse. You'd know what that's like,"
Seth said, lips curling into a sneer.
"He cost me one of my people today. That's bad enough. But he walked out of there with the Reigns kid, which is the last thing I need. I need him taken care of. Call it preemptive problem solving."
"Julie, you want me to kill him?"
"I said nothing of the sort. Jesus!"
Seth shook his head.
I want to meet him face to face. I want to talk to him. See if he's as flexible with his morals as you are. After all, once you go up in flames, I'm going to need another pet pig to play with. And one thing I've learned is every piggy has his price. Bring him to me, Hugh. Let's see if we can do some business. If I were you, I'd hope that he's a chip off the little bent bastard block. Otherwise, I will hurt you. Do we understand each other? Taff nodded. Where should I bring him? You know the old Latimer Road cinema in the Rothery. Bring him along in time for a midnight performance. There hasn't been a show there in years. Let me worry about that. You just bring the audience along like a good little piggy. The curtain goes up at 12 sharp. 31. Dead Ends. Julie was having none of it. He drove with the window down and the stereo's volume cranked up. It was summer music, vibrant and far too perky for the cool night, just the way he liked it. You could trust music in a way that you couldn't trust people. Certain tunes made you feel good, while others brought you down. They were attached to memories, of course, but that didn't change the fact that you knew what you were getting with a song in a way that you didn't with people. It was all about masks with people. They might appear perky and vibrant on the outside, but on the inside be tortured and twisted up. He trusted Josh Raines about as far as he could throw him. There was something off about the guy. It wasn't just that his story didn't add up. Julie considered himself a pretty decent judge of character. It went with the territory. But it was hard to get a read on Raines. He came across as a good guy and seemed genuinely distraught about the hell he'd put his mother through over the last week, but not enough to actually come clean about what had happened. Sure, there was enough weirdness in that flat of his to last a week if you decided to disappear down that particular rabbit hole, but a century-old crime, an obsession with some long-dead actress. Okay, he could accept it was a bit freaky that Lockwood and Raines looked like their counterparts in that long-played-out story, but looking like someone wasn't the same as what? Living 100 years without aging? Julie shook his head. Yeah, that was some weird shit. But that was pretty much par for the course these days. He was worried about his partner, and with good reason. Taff had been acting way out of character ever since he'd failed to clock off a week ago. Julie had been around to his place a couple of times to check in on him. Taff was never out of his damned dressing gown, and insisted on wearing those stupid sunglasses inside, like he was some kind of rock star on a week-long coke binge. He looked bad, and smelled so much worse. Julie decided to pay him another visit, after he'd finished with this wild goose chase. Beside him, Josh had a badly drawn map open on his lap, and was giving him directions a couple of turns at a time. The only reason Julie was humoring him was because of the comedians. What were the odds of two thieves matching the description of Clamp and Crake, both robbing the magic circle, and then being involved in a fatality that signaled the end of Josh's disappearance? Sometimes when something stinks, it really is shit, and Josh was in it up to his neck. He'd almost managed to forget about those teeth, but then he'd spent the last hour working pretty hard to convince himself that what he'd witnessed was actually the distortion of impact as his car had plowed into the screaming man, and everything else he'd thought he'd seen had been nothing more than a trick of that weird slow-motion momentum as adrenaline kicked in, everything moving so fast but seeming to go so slowly. And he almost believed it. "You'll want the next left," Josh said, "followed by a sharp right about 20 feet after that. Then we should start looking for somewhere to pull up. We'll need to go the rest of the way on foot." Julie flicked the indicator on, signaling his intent, and edged the squad car over to ride along the white line for 100 feet, waiting for a break in traffic before he swung across the other lane. Cars lined both sides of the road, constricting it so completely
that Julie had to keep glancing toward the wing mirror to be sure it wasn't grating its way down the street, one unlucky parked car at a time.